Hi, PD Stories listeners. We just wanted to take a moment to let you all know we wish you are staying safe and healthy during this challenging time. Thank you to everyone for doing their part to stay inside for our collective well-being, and a very big thank you to all the first responders out there keeping us safe.
This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm Tom Morris Jr., your host, and today we're doing something we've never done before on the show. On this episode, we'll get interactive with a successful workshop series that brings together members of the NYPD and everyday civilians to address something we've seen, heard, and talked about, and that's police and community relationships. And to do that, I'm pleased to welcome my three guests today. Terry Grease, our workshop creator and facilitator.
That's a revelation. It's a revelation for the officer. It's a revelation for the civilian.
Tracy Pinkert, community organizer and civilian participant for the workshop.
As a civilian, it's almost my responsibility to make sure that the burden of my survival is totally in my hands.
And Officer Miguel Van Brackel, who's been on patrol for 7 years with the NYPD, and before that was an EMT for the FDNY.
I did what any police officer will do when they're assigned a task. I gave it 100%.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Now, I'd like to give the listeners a little background about each of you. So, Terry, why don't we start with you?
Okay. I am an actor. I've been an actor all my life, which is getting to be a long time now. I run a company in Brooklyn called the Irondale Ensemble Project, and Irondale sort of exists at the matrix of art, education, and social justice. And this was a project that grew out of a letter I had written to Commissioner Bratton at the time after watching the Eric Garner video for ad infinitum, like we all had. And I was getting pretty angry, and it was making you numb after a while. You stopped seeing what was going on. And I started looking at it as an actor. And I thought, these people are just not communicating. They're not connecting with each other, and they're not listening to each other. And I wrote a letter. And I said, I think that it might be helpful to employ some actor techniques in police training. And I thought, that's not going to go anywhere. That's the dumbest thing I've ever done. But I had to do it. You know, you just, I put in the mail, snail mail. 2 days later, I didn't think the letter could get there that fast anymore. 2 days later, I got a call from one PP saying, come on down and talk to us. And this project started from that.
And Tracy, you've developed a very personal relationship with the Black Lives Matter movement. To my understanding, can you tell us a little bit more about what led you into that and to join this workshop voluntarily?
Well, my relationships with Black Lives Matter, it's just been who I am, right? Mm-hmm. And so as time has developed with the relationships with police and civilians, it's just like it became this whole outcry about why does our lives matter? Like, why? What's so different about who we are and the way people are being treated? So unofficially, I just started, like, you know, having conversations in the community with people about, like, what can we do on a more organic and home-based, you know, space. And then I met the chapter leader, Hawk Newsom, at a community meeting that we had a discussion right after the Eric Garner's murder. And actually at the church where Eric grew up at and where the funeral took place. And so it was interesting because while we all knew the elephant was in the room, but no one wanted to talk about the dirty stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so it just was something that I knew that in order for us to get past this, we have to address what's in that space. And so coming into Irondale, it was a colleague of mine who actually participated, I think, in cycle one or maybe. And he suggested, and I thought, like, you got to be out of your mind. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, there's no reason for me to want to do this. And I remember I was heading back in from North Carolina and he called me and he says, I know you're fighting me. I think you need to go. And I would say this to you that I'm thankful. I'm really grateful that I did take him up on that offer because I've grown, I've learned. I'm advocating still just as hard as I have in the past, but just I'm looking at things from quite a different lens. Still also just acknowledging that there's a lot more work to be done.
Did you have any preconceived notions coming into the Irondale Project?
No, I honestly did not. I didn't want to know much about the program, right? Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to fill it out for myself. But I did come in here kind of like with a hardcore attitude. Like I remember entering into that space and looking through and seeing like the officers kind of like in their corner and the civilians moving around. And I was like, I don't know if I want to mingle with the civilians because, you know, am I actually, you know, is this going to be another good feel moment for the police officers, right? And so I didn't know who was what and I didn't want my views to or my energy to kind of lapse over to people who might actually be coming in with great intentions and really wanting to do the work.
Last but not least, Officer Brandon Brackle, we're so glad to have you here. Now, if I'm correct, you were suggested by a supervisor to join this project. And what was the reason for that?
So I've been with the department for about 7 years. I've worked the entirety of my career within the 6-7 precinct. Mm-hmm. It's a very busy command. There's a lot of crime, and there's a lot of interaction with the community on a regular basis. I was approached by folks within the department that this might be something that would be helpful for me. I had several complaints that had been unsubstantiated, but
from the community,
mm-hmm. correct. And they felt that this might be something that might help, you know, with my day-to-day interactions. And so I took a chance, and I did what any police officer will do when they're assigned a task. I gave it 100%, and I had great success with Terry. It was a really, life-altering experience working with Irondale in terms of some of the things that we did and how it facilitated conversations and growth.
Did you have any preconceived notions about what you were getting into?
I had no clue.
None.
I had no clue at all. the last play I have ever done or any kind of theater was when I was in grade school. I think I was a tree or something, you know.
You were a tree in grade school. That was the extent of your thespian experiences,
absolutely.
Huh?
I had no idea. I no clue what was going to happen or, you know, what was involved. Terry and I spoke really quickly over the phone about, you know, the overall view of the project and, you know, the 7 civilians, 7 cops. I said, well, you know, at least I won't be alone. You know, there'll be 6 other people with me to go through it. So, you know, I gave it my all.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to the man who knows how to run the workshop, Terry Grease.
So.
Terry, I'm passing it over to you. Lead us into this workshop. Let's break down some barriers and see if we can even change some perspectives out there.
Okay, that sounds good. So we're going to start with a warm-up exercise. I don't think you, either Miguel or Tracy, has done this. This is an exercise I learned at the Alan Alda Center of Communicating Science, and it's called the Many Who's I Am. So, Tracy, you'll go first. I want you to just look at Miguel, and for about 1 minute, I want you to start every sentence with I am and a fact about yourself. So you can start with I am Tracy.
I am Tracy. I'm a woman. I'm single. I am black. I'm strong. I'm broken. I'm strength. I'm courage. I'm a sister. I'm a mother. I'm a friend. I'm a foe. I'm courageous. I'm fearful. I'm kind. I'm hurt. I'm angry. I'm resilient. I'm caring.
And time. Okay, Miguel, you're going to do the same thing. 1 minute. Go.
I'm Miguel. I'm a male. I'm a police officer. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm confused. I'm recovering from an injury. I can be hard on people sometimes. I'm caring. I'm compassionate. I'm an EMT.
And time. Okay. So is that easy or hard?
It's pretty hard.
Yeah.
What's hard about it?
Well, I mean, when you have to think about who you are, right? And sometimes, a lot of times, you know, I know for me, I was just, I was associating myself with all the things that I am for other people. And I had to remind myself of who I am for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also, again, I'm sharing some things about myself that I may not want to share.
Right. Yeah, it's pulling the curtain back and showing people who you are. It's kind of tough.
It is.
Yeah.
We're not used to talking about ourselves
no.
very much. We're not used to doing this.
Not in a direct way, anyway.
No. Right.
Is it transformative, what you just did?
I feel like, yeah. I feel like I'm able to own that, right? I think that sometimes when we walk into spaces, like, you know, there's some things that we want to just leave behind us, but we don't realize that we still carry them with us. So I think, like, especially, you know, the idea of just talking about being angry and being broken, right? And then still understanding that those two things can still live among being kind and caring.
Right. Yeah. You know, how everyone has different sides of their personality that sort of play at different times, right?
Right.
You play different roles at different times.
Right.
Can I ask you, Miguel, first, how might this be useful on the job?
It's good as a reality check. You know, you have to sort of play different roles at different times with people, right? I mean, you can't approach every situation the same. I don't think any officer would do that. There's certain times where you have to be tough, and there's other times where you have to be understanding, and you know, there's other times where you need to change who you are in order to make the situation better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's something that any officer can come, you know, that can understand and agree with.
Yeah, we have so many different people in us, you know. And it's not like all of a sudden you have to play a part that you're not. As you do this exercise and as you get more comfortable with it, you start to unpeel the layers of that onion and you say, I am a father, I am an uncle, I am a son, I am a grieving son, I am a dog owner, whatever it is. And you discover, sometimes surprisingly, sides of yourself that you haven't tapped into in a long time. Mm-hmm. And once they're accessible to you, then they're tools. In this situation, I'm dealing with this young man, young woman. I'm the uncle. And it's not something I have to learn to play. It's in me.
That's right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Tom, you want to try it? We don't have to.
I don't know if we have time for that.
Okay. All right. So we're going to move on. Now we're I'm taking us through 10 weeks of work in a really short time. We're up to week 3 right now. I asked Miguel to bring his police hat. We're going to make an adjustment to this exercise, and we talked about this yesterday. But let's try it this way. For a few minutes or a minute, I'm going to just ask you, Miguel, to look at your hat and really look at it in a way you haven't looked at it in a long time. Really examine it, turn it over, look at the band, the brim. And as you're looking at it, just verbalize what you're seeing.
I see a solid blue 8-point hat. It has a patent leather brim with a patent leather stripe across of it. There's brass buttons that have the same emblem that's the actual cap device, which is the emblem of New York City. It has my shield number. It has an image of one of the first watchmen. There's an eagle, and there's a Native American on the right side. And then there's a windmill in the middle, the symbol of New Amsterdam.
And as you're looking at it, if thoughts come to your head about what it makes you think about, what you feel about it, and it may just be an article of clothing that you have to wear, so we're not looking for anything is necessarily super heavy, but just verbalize, if you would, what's coming to mind.
Dedication. Sacrifice, protecting people, trust, honor, dignity, authority, respect, uniform.
Great. Okay, I want you to take that hat now and put it on your head. Tracy, just keep looking at him. Tracy, what do you see right now?
Stoic. I see pride. I see sacrifice. What's funny for me is that I get to see the hat normally during ceremonies. And many of those ceremonies are either graduation or funerals.
Okay. Take the hat off, Miguel, and give it to Tracy. Tracy, I want you to look at that hat. And first, just clear your mind for a second of everything you've said. I want you to see what you see. Just look at it for a few seconds. And as things come up for you, Tracy, start to verbalize them.
This is kind of tough because, again, not the hat itself, but the shield.
Yeah.
See the injustice, the imbalance. I see formality. The symbols that I'm not certain what they mean.
Okay, I want you to take your headphones off and put the hat on your head. Let that hat sit on your head. Tracy, how do you feel wearing that hat?
Authority. Contradictory. Almost like you have to sit with a certain posture, mm-hmm. right? So I would say it's prideful. And there's a lot of heaviness with it. And I'm not saying like the physical, the hat itself, but there's a weight that I feel that comes with it.
Okay, I'm going to stop it there. I wouldn't stop it here in the workshop, but for time's sake, you can take the hat off. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Miguel.
Can I ask a quick question here?
Yes.
Miguel, the first time you put that hat on your head would have been, I guess, at your graduation from the academy? Would that have been the first time?
Shortly before.
How did you feel the very first time you put that hat on your head?
There was a sense of pride. You know, it was towards the end of the academy, so we had gone through the entire boot camp, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. We made it to that point where we know we're graduating. Mm-hmm. So it was a sense of accomplishment that came along with being able to, you know, wear the same uniform that everyone else, you know, that wears, you know, your brothers and sisters in blue. There was a sense of continuity, you know, that I was now taking on this role, becoming more than I was before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was one of the best moments of my life, being able to put on the uniform and know that at the end of the day, I'm going to shortly go out and protect the city.
You still feel that way?
I do.
This is the first really emotional game we get to in the workshop. And I'll let these guys talk about their experience with it. But, you know, it comes from an acting exercise, which is the actor putting on the costume. And some actors really change when they put on their costumes. They put on that 19th century jacket and I feel differently. And some actors don't. They don't have the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. But by letting the hat affect the person, what's really remarkable is they've been playing together for 3 weeks and they've sometimes been doing silly things and fun things and ball tosses and things like that. And so Tracy and Miguel have become friendly, mm-hmm. more friends than they were by this time. And then Miguel puts on that hat and I think we saw it right here. His body transformed. He didn't do anything, but he just carried himself. He sat in a different way.
Became more rigid posture-wise.
Became more rigid posture-wise. All of a sudden, you know, the A-team's in town, mm-hmm. right? And you hear the civilian members of the workshop gasp when their friends Bob and Miguel and Sally, they change. Now all of a sudden, they are the pros from Dover, and there's a more militaristic look about their bodies and themselves. And that's a revelation. It's a revelation for the officer. It's a revelation for the civilian. And I'd like you to talk about what happened in our workshop.
So the day that we did this exercise, there were 14 of us, 7 civilians, 7 cops. And most of the civilians, when we transferred the hats to their heads, you know, wore it appropriately. And, you know, we had to go and adjust them a bit because they're not used to wearing, mm-hmm. You know, a cap device. And so there was one civilian in particular when she received the hat and after it was adjusted on her head, she turned it around and wore it sort of like a backwards baseball cap. And the officers that were now watching this happen, we were taking it back. I mean, you know, it's something, it's almost like sacrilege to wear your hat that way. So to see that, there was a definite impact amongst the officers. We thought it was extremely disrespectful what mm-hmm. she was doing. But we understood that she wanted to express something. So there was something else there that we had to look. So even though we weren't particularly happy with that situation, we knew that there was a message she was trying to convey. And so the whole point of the workshop was to try to understand where she was coming from and to understand why she would do that. And she went on to explain it later. But initially, there was a bit of shock. to see that.
And for us as civilians, like, we were on its line, right? And so we, again, as he said, like, we took on character, right? Mm-hmm. We put the hat on and we were just standing there with pride and shoulders back, chests out. And we had no idea that down the line, because we were looking straight ahead, that the hat was turned, right? And when it was actually exposed and how we were exposed, just because we had the opportunity to see the faces, we knew that something happened. And then it was one of the officers who just basically had pointed it out. Like, why is she wearing that hat that way? And then part of me was just like, damn. But then the other part was like, yeah. You know, like, mm-hmm. you were pushing the envelope, which we knew that this was coming. It was going to come. But I didn't know how, right? Mm-hmm. And I certainly didn't think that it would become because of an object in that way, right? We thought maybe because we start out in discussions while we're having a light meal together. And those discussions could just be like anyone's typical family dinner. Right, mm-hmm. You're just talking about how your day and things are developing and things come out, but to participate in this activity, and I don't know, for me, I was shocked, and I think for the rest of us, even as civilians, like, I think it took us back too, because we knew that she knew exactly what she was doing.
Right. Yeah,
and she was making a statement, a definitive statement.
She was making a definitive statement, right? And so that was the thing, is like, okay, game change now. Right. Mm-hmm. Because as Terry said, at this point, we become friendly.
Right.
And so now we break from this exercise.
Right. And
people are somewhat divided.
Yeah. That was the first visceral, I think, division amongst the group. I mean, at first, you know, we all kind of congregated in our own groups. You know, the cops were together and the civilians were together, and we'd have a meal and we'd do the exercises. But I think that was the first time during at least our session where there was a sharp divide as to what just happened,
yeah.
You know, and how do we get past this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a pretty
big thing. Did arguments break out, or was not? Did not, it get heated, or?
I don't remember. Do you guys remember?
No, I don't.
Not
think
that night.
Not that night.
Not that night.
But
not
there,
that
there night. Have okay. been. In uh-huh. other words, you know, Tracy, when the hat was on Tracy's head, she said, it feels heavy, a heaviness. Mm-hmm. That's come up with so many of the civilian members of the group. And they identify that heaviness as, one woman said, I never realized how much weight we put on you guys, meaning the police officers.
Just from donning the hat.
Just from donning the hat. I never realized how much weight we put on you. We ask so much of you. And that was a revelation for her. It was a revelation for all of us. Another woman who was a very strong political Black Lives Matter activist, she put the hat on and she had to take it right off. She said, I felt like it was burning a hole in my head. Hmm. And the officer who had given it to her, because we asked them to choose who they want to give it to, he was listening to her talk about this, and she had to leave the workshop at that point for that night. She came back, but she couldn't be there. She walked out. And I looked over at the officer, and he was weeping. And I said, what's the matter? He said, well, I specifically gave her the hat because I know how much she dislikes us. Mm-hmm. I gave it to her as an offering. And then when she put it on her head, I realized I hadn't seen myself in that hat since my pictures that were taken at my mother's funeral. And my mother hated cops.
Really?
She did not want me to be a cop. And I said to her, I always told her, Mama, I'm not going to be that kind of cop. I'm going to be a good cop. Now, that kind of openness, vulnerability, mm-hmm. doesn't come out a lot, especially in mixed groups of civilians and police officers.
Right.
But that led to enormous empathy and a greater sense of understanding and new perspective on everybody's part.
A breakthrough.
A real breakthrough. Completely.
Let's move on to the next phase here.
Okay. So we're going to all, the three of you mm-hmm. are going to do this one. It's a conversation okay. game. I'm going to give you a topic of conversation, and anybody can start and say the first thing about whatever they want to say. Before the next person can join in, you have to repeat in your own words what the person before you has said to their satisfaction. You have to get their check off on it. So you'll start the next sentence by saying, so what I heard you say was, and then you paraphrase it, And if the person says, yep, that's what I said, or no, that's not what I said, then you try again. And both of you can try again.
We're going to pause this powerful conversation to tell you about a sponsor of ours. If there's one thing people are getting experimental with right now, it's how they're doing their hair. Some are growing it out, some are going for a big chop, and some are even having fun coloring it. So why not join in the fun with Madison Reed? My wife really loves the color she gets with it, and it's very affordable. PD Stories listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with the code PD Stories at madison-reed.com. It's a top-notch quality product to get the job done from the safety of your home. Many Madison Reed clients comment on how their new hair color has improved their lives. This is game-changing color you can do yourself and look as if you just came from the salon. What makes Madison Reed color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. PD Stories listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with the code PD Stories. That's code PD Stories. Stay home, stay healthy, and stay looking fashionable.
Hey, I got a new podcast coming. It's called Theory.
Don't you know?
This is Theo Rossi. Our world is changing. For many of us, it'll never feel the same. The important thing to remember is that we are all in this together. And that's some of what I want to talk about on my new show, Theory. We're going to discuss the things that no one ever does. The real talk, the sacrifice, and the struggle that everyone goes through. My life has kind of put me in a unique position to see things honestly. This is Theo Rossi, and my new show, Theory, launches on April 8th, officially on Spotify, Podcast One, and Apple Podcasts.
I'm going to launch right into a rather controversial topic here.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about the firing of Officer Pantaleo. He was the officer who instituted the chokehold. People say it was a chokehold. Some people say it was not a chokehold. That led to the tragic death of Eric Garner. Officer Pantaleo was just fired after being put on desk duty, I guess, for 5 years. So it's been 5 years since he was going to know what his fate was. And it was very controversial, but the Commissioner O'Neill, took the step to fire him. And I'd like to know your opinion about A, whether that was justified, and B, will it change anything? So, have at it. Who wants to start that one off?
I believe that many people believe he should have been fired.
So, I hear you say that you believe that many people believe that he should have been fired. And is that correct? Is that the right gist? So you feel that it was a justified decision of him being fired?
I believe that many people believe he should have been fired.
He should have been fired, right. So overall, there's many sides to this topic. That's a more fair assessment of what you said, right? I believe along those same lines. There's different viewpoints as to what happened and to why he was fired. And the calls for him to be fired differ amongst many people. And I don't want to spend the whole time double-speaking, but as many people feel it was a justified decision, there are many people that feel it was unjustified.
So what I hear you saying is that while there are many who feel that he should have been fired, you feel that there are just as many who feel that he shouldn't have been fired.
Yes.
Well, I feel that it wasn't enough. And we can go through all the different reasons, but I guess because of my personal connection and to see this family grieve because of his not being fired at the time, I feel like it wasn't enough.
So what I hear you saying is that you believe he should have perhaps been sent to prison for what happened?
I believe that perhaps prison and maybe some other damages, financial something for this family for their loss. It wouldn't bring the individual back, but I think that it would it takes away the act of or the position of you being an officer of saying that because this crime has been committed that you are exempt from the weight of it because of the uniform or because of the swearing in.
So is what I hear you saying that only one side has suffered in this, the Garner side, as opposed to the officer's side?
Well, I know that, of course, there are many people who have been harmed by this act, this event. I do believe that they have a member who will never come back. Mm-hmm. There is a member that will never come back by what, no matter what decision the courts make, whether he loses his, you know, Pantaleo lost his job, this individual life is gone forever.
Tom, you want to try that? Paraphrase that?
So what I understand you to be saying is that you recognize the gravity of the consequence the officer suffered, and yet the full gravity of the reality of Mr. Garner's death is far more permanent and more searing in its hardcore pain and suffering across the board.
Yes, that's correct.
So, Tom, if I heard you correctly, you're saying that the overall impact of what happened is greater than the punishment that was received by Officer Pantaleo.
What I'm saying is that death is permanent. Eric Garner's death is permanent. And no matter how you look at this, we will always go back to the beginning of the incident in many ways and what was at the very core of the initial encounter, selling loose cigarettes. But at the same time, I think that we will also have to understand that anyone who takes someone else's life is going to pay a price for the rest of their life, too, whether they go to prison or not.
So if I hear what you're saying correctly, the core of what happened in terms of Eric Garner losing his life is something that will also impact the officer in ways other than just legally and professionally.
For the rest of his life, emotionally.
And I have to agree with that. There's a distinction to be made between Eric Garner's death and the legalities of what happened. And by that I mean no officer goes out to do their job looking to murder someone. And I wholeheartedly believe that with every fiber of my being. I don't believe that Eric Garner's death was a murder. There's a legal distinction there. I also don't agree with the fact that he lost his life. Whenever force is used, it's an ugly thing. There is nothing glamorous about using force to facilitate any kind of police activity. And the officers that I work with and the people that I trust my life with always use force as a last resort when words fail.
Tracy, do you think you can sum that up and put in one last word here?
Miguel, what I believe I heard you say was that the loss of any life is important. It's not diminished. And that the officers that you know and that you believe who's taken on this oath, they go out with the intentions to not use any physical force that would require someone, that someone would actually lose their life. I hear you say that because of the legality of it, that it's not a murder. But And that's Nat, I'm gonna go. It's what I'm saying. It's what I'm summarizing is that what I hear. Am I able to say it correctly?
95% of that. So there's a distinction legally between homicide and murder, right? If it was in fact murder, then he would have been convicted of that. But he never was. He wasn't indicted of a murder. He wasn't convicted of a murder. So there wasn't that threshold met in order to call that act murder. And that's the distinction that I'm making there. Does that make sense?
Try that, Tracy.
So because of the legality distinctions of whether or not it's considered a murder-side, a homicide or a murder, you will address it as it not being a murder.
That's right.
Okay, yes. I'm going to stop it there. I know there's so much more to say, mm-hmm. but I'm going to stop it there. We would, very often this would go on for half an hour, sometimes 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But I just want you to take note of how hard it is to really listen and really hear. I mean, everybody's sitting differently now, and I could see everybody sort of engage their whole body mm-hmm. as they were trying to understand what was being said. And sometimes, as you say, you got 95% of it, but she missed something. So then you had to rearticulate. And what this exercise does is it reminds us that because we say something doesn't mean it's heard the way we think we're being heard. And especially when we've got cultural barriers to overcome, we've got language barriers to overcome, because I'm used to saying what I believe, doesn't mean you hear it the way Tracy has heard it or the way I've heard it. Mm-hmm. And we need that constant check-in. We need that constant affirmation of, do you understand what I mean?
And as I listen to you say that, three words keep going through my mind that we all heard, I can't breathe. And that's something that will never be removed from Eric Garner's death and what we saw happen, regardless of the final adjudication of it. Those three words will always be part of the American discussion about policing in America. And I'm going to leave it right there unless you want to add in something. But those three words just kept echoing in my mind as we were having this discussion. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And then the man stopped breathing and the life was gone. And the debate began.
I have only one thing to add to that. What would have happened if one of the officers say, did I hear you say you're having trouble breathing?
We'll never know.
We'll never know. But it's something to think about. So what we're going to do now is we're going to read a scene from a play. It's a play called Graveyard Shift by a man named Cord Tuttle. It is a fictionalized play based on a real-life incident. Most of the play is fiction. The scene we're going to read, however, is not. It's verbatim what happened. I don't want to talk about, at this point, who this is about. I think it will become clear to many people, and we'll talk about it afterwards. So I'd just like you to read it. It's a traffic stop scene. A police officer stops a woman in her car. I'd like Miguel to play the officer and Tracy to play the passenger.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi.
The reason for your stop is you failed to signal lane change. You got your driver's license and insurance with you? What's wrong? How long you been in Texas?
I just got here yesterday.
Okay. Do you have a driver's license?
Didn't I give you my driver's license?
No, ma'am. Okay. Where are you headed to now?
Walmart.
Give me a few minutes, all right? Okay, ma'am. You okay?
I'm waiting on you. This is your job. I'm waiting on you. Whatever you want me to do.
I don't know. You seem very irritated.
I am. I really am because I feel like this is crap. What am I getting a ticket for? I was getting out of your way and you were speeding up, tailing me. So I move over and you stop me. So yeah, I'm a little irritated, but that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket.
Are you done?
You asked me what was wrong and I told you.
Okay.
So now I'm done, yeah.
Okay. You mind putting out your cigarette, please, if you don't mind?
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
Why? No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
No, you don't have the right to have...
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse and I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I'm getting removed for a failure to signal?
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order.
And I'm calling my lawyer.
Get out of the car now.
I'm calling my lawyer.
I'm going to remove you. I'm going to yank you out of here.
Okay, so you're going to yank me
out
of the car? Okay.
All right, let's do this. 2547 County. Get out! Yeah, we're going to.
Don't touch me.
Get out of the car.
Don't touch me. I'm not
under
arrest.
You are under arrest.
You don't have the right to take me in. You are, I'm not.
2547 County, FM
1098. You do not have the right to take
me. 14, send me another unit.
For what? What am
I, why am I under arrest? Get out of the car now! I said get out of the car!
Why am I being apprehended and you just opened my car door? You just opened up my car door.
I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
Drag me out of my own car.
Get out of the car!
So now you're going to stun me?
I will light you up!
So now you're going to stun me?
I will light you up!
So now you're going to stun me?
I'm going to light you up!
And scene. Okay. That's scene. Now, I want to hear the scene again. And Miguel, I'd like you to play the cop again. And Tom, I'd like you to be the passenger.
Okay.
So the only thing that's going to change, Miguel, is it's sir instead of ma'am.
Gotcha.
And just hear but how it changes the dynamic, if it does.
Okay.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
The reason for your stop is you failed to signal lane change. You got your driver's license and insurance with you?
What's wrong?
How long have you been in Texas?
Just got here yesterday.
Okay. Do you have a driver's license?
Didn't I give you my driver's license?
No, sir. Where are you headed to now?
Walmart.
Okay. Give me a few minutes, all right? Okay, sir. You okay?
I'm waiting on you. I mean, this is your job. I'm waiting on you. Whatever you want me to do.
I don't know. You seem very irritated.
I am. I really am. Because I feel like it's crap, man. I mean, what am I getting the ticket for? I was getting out of your way. You were speeding up, tailing me. So I move over and you stop me. So yeah, I'm a little irritated, but that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket, so...
Are you done?
You asked me what was wrong. I just told you.
Okay.
So now I'm done, yeah.
Okay. You mind putting out your cigarette, please, if you don't mind?
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
Why am I... No, you don't have the right to...
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Step out or I'll remove you.
I refuse. I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I'm getting removed for failure to signal?
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order.
And I'm calling my lawyer.
Get out of the car now or I'm going to remove you. I'm going to yank you out of here.
Okay.
Get out.
All right.
All right, let's do this. 2547 County, get out.
Yeah, we're going to. Yo, don't touch me.
Get out of the car.
Don't touch me. I'm not under arrest. You don't have the right to take me in.
You are under arrest.
For what? I'm under arrest for what?
2547 County, FM 1098, just the 14. Send me another
unit. For what?
Get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
Get out of the car now.
You're trying to give me a ticket for failure to...
I say, get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended? You just opened my car
door. I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're threatening to drag me out of
get
my
out of
own
the car.
Car? Oh, you're going to...
I will light you up.
You're going to shoot me? You're going to stun me?
I will light you up.
You're going to... What are you...
And
light
scene.
Me up.
Okay, great. One more time. Tracy, you're now an African-American female cop and a white passenger. Let's hear it again. And Tom, while you're listening, I just want you to take a note, you know... knock on the table or raise your hand every time you hear either a miscommunication or an escalation of this event.
Okay.
Okay? So you don't need your script. Just listen to what's going on.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
The reason for your stop is you failed to signal a lane change. You got your driver's license and insurance with you? What's wrong? How long have you been in Texas?
Just got here yesterday.
Okay. Do you have your driver's license?
Did I give you my driver's license?
No, sir. Where are you headed to now?
Walmart.
All right, give me a minute. All right? Okay, sir. You okay?
I'm waiting on you. You, this is your job. I'm waiting on you. Whatever you want me to do.
I don't know. You seem very irritated.
I really am, because I feel it's crap. What am I getting a ticket for? I was getting out of your way. You were speeding up, tailing me. I move over and you stop me. So yeah, I'm a little irritated. But that doesn't stop you from giving me a ticket, so...
Are you done?
You asked me what was wrong, and I told you. So yeah, now I'm done.
Okay. You mind putting your cigarette out, please, if you don't mind?
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step out of your car now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of your car.
What? Why? No. You don't have the right. You do not have the right to do that.
Step out of your car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I have the right now. Step out or I will remove you.
I refuse. I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I'm getting removed.
I'm giving you a lawful order. Get out of your car now or I'm going to remove you.
And I'm calling my lawyer.
I'm going to yank you out of here.
Okay. You're going to yank me out of my car?
Get out of the car.
Okay.
All right. Let's do this. 2547 County. Get out. Yeah, we're going.
Yeah, don't touch me.
Get out of the car.
Don't touch me.
You are under arrest.
I am not under arrest. You do not have the right to take me in.
2547 Count FM 1097-98. Justin, a 14. Send me another unit.
For what?
Get out of your car.
I'm under arrest for what? Why am I being apprehended?
Get out of your car now.
You're trying to give me a ticket for failure to
sit. I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
You just opened my car door.
Get out of the car.
And you're going to stop
me? I will light you up.
Okay. Scene.
Again, we take a short pause to tell you about another sponsor of ours. If you're looking for a way to pass the time right now from the comfort of your own home, you should check out Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. It's a perfect respite from the doom and gloom in the news. It has challenging puzzles, a great story to it, and it gets your brain going. And heck, it's just a good time. While the game has its challenges, it's also a casual game for adults that anyone can play. You can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. Best Fiends is really a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike any other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
I think it's very clear to all of us who know this story that it's about Sandra Bland, the woman who was stopped at a traffic violation in Texas and then ended up in the jail cell dead several hours later. Okay, I'm going to start with you, Tom. What did you hear? What did you experience with any of those read-throughs?
Well, it clearly escalates quickly, but I think that the primary jump-off point for this whole miscommunication is when the officer asks to have the cigarette put out. I think people watching on both sides of this will think, well, does he have the authority to ask a person to put their cigarette out in their car? Would he have asked someone else to put their cigarette out if it wasn't this particular woman? So I think that's when things start to go south immediately. And I think that she's making an error also by perhaps, even though she has every right to smoke in her car, I remember from the very beginning of this incident, I wish that she had actually just put the cigarette out to see if that would have not led to an escalation. I think it wasn't a lawful order. You have no authority to tell someone when they're in their own car to put their cigarette out. But as a courtesy to that person that doesn't want to smell the smoke, cop or no cop, if somebody asked me, hey, would you put your cigarette out? I'd be like, oh, if it's bothering you, sure. So I think that's where things start to go south.
Miguel, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that's what we found in the when we did our sessions as well. That was the one thing where everyone fixated on, that moment where, you know, the officer's asking the passenger to, you know, put out that cigarette. And that's where things sort of, you know, start diverging, right? That's where, one person gets entrenched in their idea and one person gets entrenched in the other. The one thing that I did mention during the whole conversation when we had it was that there are some safety considerations. I think maybe the officer decided he was going to arrest her at that point. Maybe he wanted to put that cigarette out so that he wouldn't get burned trying to pull her out of the car. But, you know, that's Monday morning quarterbacking a situation that, you know, I wasn't there to make. But I think there might have been some other issues there that I wish might have been, because all we ever heard was the audio. I never saw the video.
You did?
No.
I have a question for all of you. Does it make a difference? Did it make a difference if the officer was a woman or if the passenger was a man?
I feel like it did. I think like it just in listening to your reading that you guys just did, I felt like the aggression didn't really begin on the officer's part until a little later towards the end, in terms of the volume of the voice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes when you approach matters, I think that sometimes, I believe that gender does come into play just as well as race. And so I do believe that it can make a difference, and it has.
I think I heard the same thing you did. And it really, for the first time, that the officer was more subdued longer when there was a male voice coming back at him. And Tom, I know that you were tapping on the table every mm-hmm. time you heard an escalation, mm-hmm. And you already said that it seemed to escalate more as it went on.
And rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you would say, and this is hard because we know the history of this, does blame fall on one side or another?
You had to ask me that, right? you know, when you sit back and look at an incident like this, and we all know what the end result of this particular encounter was with Sandra Bland.
Sandra Bland, yeah.
And she ended up dead hours later in the county jail there in Texas. And we know that if you go back to the beginning of the encounter, it was failure to signal. Something so minor that led to an escalation that ultimately the end result was this motorist died in a jail hours later. So I think the best thing I can say is that these tragic incidents that we have audio and video for give us an opportunity to see how something can be done different the next time, by you, the driver, you, the passenger, you, the cop. This is a brutal, lethal, ultimately learning lesson, and that's really my perspective on it. I've always said that a lot of things would never happen that are really horrific if this exact two people didn't encounter each other, and a lot of times it really right. is two people that if they had never met. If another officer had pulled her over for the same thing, the outcome could have been completely different. If she had had a different personality and a different posture, the outcome could have been completely different. So for me, I'm a third eye on this. And I just look at this as a lethal learning lesson for American policing and for American citizens.
I agree. And that's one of the reasons this workshop exists, is to start to examine some of these interactions. So I'd just like to hear from Miguel and Tracy. How did you feel
doing the scene again? How do you feel during that interchange?
I forgot how quickly your adrenaline starts to flow when you start reading that scene. It's very provocative, obviously. And it just generates a lot of emotion, and a lot of negative emotion. You know, you don't want to be in that situation. I don't want to even be reading the situation just because of how difficult it is to get through, you know, emotionally, knowing the outcome, knowing what will ultimately transpire. Mm-hmm. Right.
Tracy?
You, when we read it, I remember just having this overwhelming feeling, right? And a sense of like fearful, like, you know, just really, really fearful. And then as I read it again now, I just think about just, you know, hearing Tom talk about, like, you know, the two people meeting each other at different people, the outcome would have been different. But I also feel like sometimes I feel as a civilian, it's like it's almost my responsibility to make sure that the burden of my survival is totally in my hands, right? And so that also becomes a huge weight. It's like, I don't know what you've experienced from the stop before me. I don't know what happened with you before you came out of your home. And it's the same thing for the officer. But I just felt like, you know, like kind of like what I say to my son, knowing your rights is important. Exercising your rights are important. But knowing the space in which you are doing that and with whom you are doing with, it's just as important. It's not enough for you to say, like, I know that you can't do this, right? Mm-hmm. Because that becomes a defensive moment for everyone. And I think that in this scene, you realize that there's a power play that's happening. There's a dance that's happening. And it's just like, who's going to have the last dance? Who's going to win this dance? And unfortunately, she didn't.
And who's having a bad day before they encounter this other person?
Right. Exactly.
I say this a lot on this on PD Stories. And in every profession, there's a percentage of people that should have never been in that profession. A bad dentist probably won't kill you, and he doesn't have the authority to take your freedom. But a bad police officer can do both, take your freedom and take your life. So you've worked with some officers who you knew should never have ever. Even though they went to the academy, they passed all the tests, and they looked good in the uniform, and they hit the streets. But you knew once you started working with some of those people that a small percentage should not be out there with that kind of authority.
There are definitely some people that, you know, like you said, in every profession.
In
every profession, mm-hmm. You know. And to go along that line, you know, in every profession, there are people that if they're doing their job badly, you know, aren't the archetype for the rest of the profession. Where policing, that's the exact opposite. So you may have a bad dentist and no one, you know, there's plenty of bad dentists, but no one says, oh, I went to this dentist, he was terrible. All dentists are terrible. But I think with policing, you get the exact opposite, right? So you have a guy, this is a terrible police officer. So all police officers are terrible. And a lot of people follow that line thinking and they just, and it just becomes, you know, that's, what people think of. Oh, well, you know, and not for everyone. That's a generalization. All sweeping generalizations are wrong, right? But yeah.
I think it also goes back to the uniform. You know, the uniform, you're supposed to look alike.
Right.
Every NYPD officer wears the same uniform. I just discovered in our most recent workshop when somebody was adjusting the hat on somebody's head, the civilian's head, they said the hat is deliberately worn low brim over your eyes, so you can't tell where the officer is looking at any given time. I never knew that was a rationale or a regulation. It just looks spooky. You know?
Terry, I'm sorry. Yeah. I just feel like for me, I think that, you know, sometimes we don't look at the historical context, right, around what policing looks like in America. And I think that that's something that we kind of forget about, right? I think that if we talk about, like, you know, just how it came about and how it is. And it did. I think that sometimes people just kind of carry that with them. I don't remember, like, as a kid in the community, I mean, we saw the officers and, you know, some of them would stop and they would talk to you. So you kind of, I guess you want to say officer friendly, right? But then you also knew that those same officers that were, you know, would kind and said hello to you, you know, maybe went like two buildings down and you saw a whole nother encounter. You saw a whole different relationship. And so that's what I'm saying. It's like for me, so when I look at the hat, I look at the hat as a part of ceremonial. Mm-hmm. I think that when I reflect back to the officers that patrolled in spaces where I grew up at, they didn't have the hat on, mm-hmm. right? And when they enter spaces, and it wasn't necessarily to enter the space to get to know you, and to a sense of like I really care about your well-being, right? I know that in the community that I grew up, and after my parents' divorce, we moved to public housing.
Where was
and,
this? Where?
In Brooklyn. Uh-huh. So it's right up the block, one block away. There was certainly a different way that you saw how the officers interact and they patrolled in spaces, right? And so for me, it was always like, yes, I want to look at the individual, but I also know that the individual is a part of a collective. And I also know that as part of the collective, you're part of a system. And we all somehow play a role in that system, right? It's kind of like an ecosystem of things that takes place. So I've learned to say, yes, these are the individuals, but I also look at the fact that, like, will you call out a bad partner if they're doing the wrong thing, right? Mm-hmm. Will you hold them to the same standards? Because I know I'm going to check my neighbor, right? I'm going to say, like, yo, that's not cool. Like I know that I'm going to do that. And I want to believe that the other individuals on the other end are doing the same. But I think that the system of it, and I think that's the whole thing, the whole idea of just how we enter spaces with a lot of stuff. And sometimes our stuff shows up differently. And I think that that's, you know, that's just kind of like what it is. Like, I want to believe that the person who's coming in, you know, I work in a school and I know that our former school chancellor wanted to develop stronger relationships with police officers and young people in the community. And I was a little bit resistant to it because I was saying they're going to come in, they're going to play basketball with these boys, they're going to, you know, it's going to be all this like friendliness, but no one's not talking about how it looks outside the community, because outside of the school, because on the streets, you are perceived to automatically be wrong, be bad, be
being
resistant.
Being young and black, right? In certain neighborhoods.
In certain neighborhoods, right? So, but because of some of this, I've learned, like, I met Miguel and I've called Miguel. I don't know if he shared that with you, mm-hmm. and said to him, like, I feel like I trust you enough that I would want to bring you into a space because I know that we did some work together, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah. That we've done some work, that I can have you come in and talk to the young people because I know that you're bringing something different than maybe the officer that I didn't know. And I know that you're willing to put yourself in the hot seat, because those kids are going to come real and they're going to come raw, right?
Yeah.
And they're not going to let you get by with just, you know? So I'm willing to do that. But I also want to, like, I also have to acknowledge the fact that when officers enter spaces, especially spaces of children who are black and brown, it's not necessarily the same. And so it takes a lot of digging to get through in terms of being able to say, like, people trust me, right? And so if I'm bringing you in, I know that not only do they trust me, but they're going to hold me just as accountable, or maybe even more so, because I brought you into a very sacred space. And that's the space of not, you know, we're not a trusting community and we have a right not to be, right? But I know that I've done some work with you.
And the flip side of that is how officers feel ganged up on by the community that you're talking about.
Of course.
That's upset with how the policing is done.
Absolutely.
And with what they perceive as harassment of black males and black females sometimes as well. Do you feel, or explain how that sentiment is amongst officers that you know? Do they feel like they're ganged up on by this issue and by the community, but particularly the black community?
Well, there are a lot of issues that have come up over the last couple of years, and we're all aware of them. You know, most recently, the situation with officers getting hit with water.
The balloons, water balloons?
The water balloons, the buckets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who is assigned to a command, regardless of which command you go to, you go out into the community in order to do the best that you can. Mm-hmm. Right, and that's how I approach my job. That's how the officers I know approach their job. Mm-hmm. Who you're interacting with, we don't get to determine that, right? So when we get a call, a 911 call, we're going and we're responding, and who's ever there is there, and we're going to handle the situation the best way that we can. Many times when we go into, you know, our community that I currently patrol, you know, we're helping. We're out there. We're doing the good job. We're doing the good work, and we're thanked for what we do. And then there are times where we're just trying to do our job and we're not. And, you know, it's definitely disparaging to know that there are people in the community that just see us as just all bad without even knowing us personally, mm-hmm. Making assumptions based on previous, you know, interactions. Mm-hmm. But I am hopeful, you know, with programs like this, the situation that Tracy and I have dealt with and throughout this program and through some of the interactions we had in other programs, that there is a bridge that can be made, right? And the more positive interactions that we have, especially with young people, the more positive the outcomes are going to be. So.
But you're tall. How tall are you?
6'3".
About how much you weigh?
Oh, I used to be a little thinner. I'm about 240 now. I was hurt, so.
I mean, you're a pretty imposing figure. I mean, I imagine in uniform when you walk up to somebody, you're a big guy.
Yeah.
And, oh, my goodness. He came to one of our... Remember one of the workshops you came in uniform?
Yes.
He used to have a shaved head, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a shaved head. More
I looked...
kind of paramilitary looking?
Yeah, absolutely. And I let it grow out after I got hurt. But, yeah, I mean, you know, full uniform that first session, that was pretty awkward. I didn't get the memo that I was supposed to come in civilian clothes. So.
But you came to the workshop willing to be vulnerable, to bare your soul in a way that you probably had never anticipated in your wildest dreams you would ever do something like this project.
And I have to say, right from the get-go, Miguel said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it 100%. If I asked him to quack like a duck, he quacked like a duck. If I asked him to sing a song, he sang a song. Man never sang before publicly.
Never want to do that again.
But either. He asked and was allowed to do a solo in the final performance.
Really?
I did, yeah. And hopefully that'll never be, you know, recirculated again.
But it was so real. Uh-huh. It was beautiful. I have to say it was one of the best things in the show.
You stepped all the way out of your comfort zone.
I did.
Being a tree in elementary school in the play.
Yes.
To singing on stage as an adult police officer in a workshop. This is amazing.
If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it right. And I tried.
Terry, as the creator and facilitator of this workshop, this unique project that you've started, what have been the biggest aha moments for you? You didn't know what was going to happen when you started this either. You had no idea.
No, I had none. I hoped we would bring about some sort of enhanced communication abilities. I had no idea how intense this could get. I remember there was a time, I think it was the second round of workshops, so we're still, and I still feel I'm learning, but we were really learning how to do this. And we were playing that conversation game. And it was a female officer and a female civilian. And the civilian looked at the officer and said, "You're the only one in this room I'm afraid of because I think you could kill me." And this female officer, who was short, mm-hmm. She was a sweet person, a mom. Mm-hmm. That's how she identified herself. You could see her eyes sort of spin around in her head. And she said, what do you? She said, "Last week, you said something about how you don't recognize the good guys from the bad guys. And if that's the case, how do I know you're not going to shoot me? You scare the out of me." Mm-hmm. And they got into it. They started really getting at it. And it was really intense. And
you
I
let it go. You just let them.
I did. And now I'm thinking, what am I doing? I'm not equipped to handle this. Mm-hmm. Am I going to damage one of these people? This is really stressful. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I just, okay, stop. Let's sing. Hmm. 2 seconds later, these two women who I thought were going to kill each other, arms around each other's shoulders, "I like the flowers. I like the daffodils. I like the..." I almost wet myself. I thought, holy mackerel. And then I start, you know, and I couldn't sleep that night. It was just so jarring. And I thought, okay, the need to reach out, the need to connect with each other is so strong. It's so much a part of our DNA. We want this. This is how human beings need to be together. And that other stuff, it's there, but get that out of the way so we can share our voices together and we can put our arms around each other and relate as human beings. That was a revelation to me. And it's colored the rest of the way I've dealt with the workshops. And I realized how important it was, A, that we eat together mm-hmm. every night and that we keep singing together. Because when those conversations get rough, I don't want to say chill out. I just change the temperature by going to that. Or one of my other facilitators changes the temperature and goes to something else. And it keeps the conversation in the room. We had another situation where a cop and a young a Hispanic man who was definitely a provocateur. He came into that workshop to
light matches.
Yeah, right. Mm. So it was well on in the workshop series, and everybody was getting along pretty well. And one of the guys said, so I've got to ask you, if you saw a cop getting beaten up by a gang, and you had your cell phone out, you had this on video, would you turn that cell phone in? And the guy said, no, I wouldn't. He said, you wouldn't turn it in? He said, no, because I feel like what's happened historically is so devastating, I wouldn't want to do anything that helped the police. Well, can you imagine how hurtful that was to that officer?
Mm-hmm.
And that officer, he left the room, he left the workshop, and he went out and he got as far as the stairs, and he couldn't leave.
He came back
mm-hmm. to continue the conversation.
And
our workshop ends at 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. They stayed there till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Really?
The officer must have left 7 or 8 times and then come back and left and come back. And again, you start to see they need to connect. They need to understand each other. They don't need to agree.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, I say this at the beginning, and I so mean this because people doubt me on this. This is not about kumbaya. This is not an advertisement for the police department, nor is it police bashing. Mm-hmm. Although people come away thinking it's one or the other.
It's bridge building.
It's bridge building, and it's about understanding, not necessarily agreement.
Miguel, as a participant, how has this workshop experience changed you, improved you, hurt you, or what's it done for you?
When I first started the workshop, like I mentioned before, you know, I approached it like I would any job. I gave it everything I had. And, you know, when I first got there, after that first night, I was in uniform. I was doing some theater exercises that I had no idea even existed, let alone would ever participate in. You know, I sat in my car and I thought to myself, what the hell did I get myself into?
Right.
So foreign in every way from what I'm used to and things that I've done. It's just completely foreign to me. And I said, you know what? I put myself to this, so I'm just going to stick with it. You know, I'm going to get through this workshop. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. And then the actual exercises that we did at the workshop, they started out as silly games, but a lot of them have real impact in policing. That game that we played earlier, where you continue the conversation, mm-hmm. it forces you to actively listen to the person that you're interacting with. And we're taught that in the academy, but to practice it in that capacity, knowing that at the end of 10 weeks you're going to be putting on a play in front of an audience, it adds an urgency, and it lets you focus on the work. You know, towards the end of the performance, it really did change how I approach situations, you know, when I'm out on the street. And even with my family, there's a lot that we did and that I learned that during the program that actually did help, not only personally, but professionally.
Tracy, how about you? How did this experience change your life?
Well, I know that initially, because I don't know that I really had any real expectations going in, right? And as I move forward, I just kind of just thought about, like, how am I responding to officers when they enter spaces, or that I enter spaces and I see them? You know, am I mean mugging them? Am I, you know, giving a smile and say, like, you know, hey? So I find myself, like, you know, intentionally making sure that I made myself a little bit more inviting, wanting to go out and actually do not necessarily the theater part of the interactions with civilians and police officers. So now what I do is, like, I'm on a perimeter of my school building a little longer, right? Just to be like, yo, back up. I got them, right? And I think it's good because then, you know, the young people see my interactions with the officers. You know, sometimes, you know, they'll go over to, I was riding my bike one time against traffic, and one of the officers, he was like, Pinker, get out of the road. You know, so it's things like that. But, you know, I think that this is something that it's not for everybody. It really isn't.
No.
It totally is not for everyone. And again, I love the fact that Terry keeps reminding us that it's not about us agreeing. It's about being able to just come into a space and really have those tough discussions.
Tracy, as an African-American mother of a son in Brooklyn, what do you teach your son about how to interact with the police prior to this workshop experience and post-workshop?
Well, I've always taught him with any adult to be respectful, right? If they're directing you to do something that you know that you're safe, of course, then you follow that. And if you're not in agreement, then you bring it home. And I think I still hold him to that even when it comes to officers. The only thing is that I would just say to him is just to be a little bit more mindful in terms of, like, his body language, right? Making sure that, you know, if you encounter an officer and they're giving you a directive, that you are a part of what we've learned is the whole, like, continuing the conversation, mirroring, like, you know, what I've heard, you're asking me to, just so that there is clarity in that. So I don't know that I've done anything any differently. I think that what I've just done is just kind of reiterate the fact that, you know, I want you to be respectful. I want you to, if you disagree with anything, the first thing I need you to look at is those insignias. Forget the name tag, the insignia. And then let me know. But I think that because I'm so proactive about it, and then I think that he watches the way that I am, like, carrying myself around police officers, that he gets it. You know, I think we had an opportunity to ride with Miguel one time, and
with your son,
with my son. And so the first thing I said was, like, "You're not going in the back seat. That you'll never experience."
Oh. That
psychologically, you'll never experience that. And so he got in the front seat with Miguel, and, you know, I know my boy's, you know, body language. He's like, "Ah, this woman, she's always throwing me."
How old is he?
He's 15.
Okay.
You know, and I could tell he's, like, probably not happy about the fact that, like, why can we get on a subway? Why are we not Ubering? Like, you got me in a police vehicle, right? But I wanted him to, I like, in a lot of ways, of making him feel a little uncomfortable, right? Because I feel like that stretches him. And Miguel was just basically, you know, showing him, you know, the dashboard and all the stuff that happens in the car. So a lot of my discussion with him is always about just, you know, knowing where you're going. I don't say to him wrong place, wrong time, because history has shown that there is no wrong place, wrong time, you know?
I mean,
you know, so
look at the guy in Texas who was in his own apartment.
Right.
So, no, there's, you never know.
Yeah. So I just always just tell him just, you know, just to always be respectful and just, you know, we hear come home and come home safely, right? Just come home.
I'm curious, have you ever had a bad experience on the street with a police officer personally?
I did once, and it was just the dumbest thing ever. I live in public housing, so you're not allowed to have your dog off the leash. And she's, like, my dog at the time was, like, less than 25 pounds, and she just wanted to run. And it was, I recall it was, like, an early Sunday morning, and I let her off. And she went down a block, and a police van came down the block, and it jumped on the sidewalk. So in my head, I was just, like, trying to call my dog back because I was afraid that something was going on that I didn't see, right? And so she came and she jumped into my arms and I was holding her and the officers were coming towards me, again, still not thinking it's about me. And they stopped me and it was just like, "Do you have ID?" And I'm like, "I don't have an ID," because I didn't come outside with ID that day. And I was like, "I don't have any identification." And so, and I certainly was going to invite them because I was, like, right in my apartment building. Like, I was going to invite them to come to, you know, to my home to get ID. So, you know, they began to write. So I was like, "What is this about?" And they said, "For not having your dog on a leash." Like, I was
creating... They're writing you a citation?
Right, because they said I was creating an unsafe environment. And I was just like, she's less than 25 pounds. Like, so I started to do what I said to my son not to do, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, you've just created an unsafe environment. You just literally, like, jumped your van on a sidewalk to come... So then... And then I found myself, like, really getting angry. And I said to them, the one thing that I should have never said to anyone concerning a job was, like, you know, like, there's real crime happening. Go, mm-hmm. like... You know, like...
Yo, why don't you go chase some real criminals?
Yeah. So that was it. And I was just like, real crime. And I'm telling you, like, I was going to go and, like, plead my own case. Like, I took photos of my dog. I have a duffel bag. I was going to put her in the bag because, you know, we have...
And they gave you a citation?
Well, they did. And so I had to go appear at where we're at. It's called the Justice Center. And it's a place
in Brooklyn.
Right, yeah. In Brooklyn, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So I knew the judge. I was like, I'm gonna put my dog in a bag and I'm gonna show, you know, Judge Calabresi, like, look at this little dog. And I can't believe they have me doing this. And my friend said to me, don't you do that. Like, just be quiet, go in there, see what, because I was ready to, like, I was gonna do Perry Mason in there, you know. I was ready for it, but you know so when I entered into that space, you know, the judge of course is looking at me and saying, like, he's thinking I'm there to support and advocate for you know, for youth, because that's what I do.
Uh-huh.
And he realized it was for me, and he was like, you gotta be kidding me. So he was just like,
so he dismissed the citation.
Well, yeah, I guess in a way he did. He just said, like, don't get any more trouble.
No anything.
Fine. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was like, you know, don't, no more. No more trouble.
And did the officer come to court for that?
I didn't see the officer. I don't recall seeing the officer. I just thought it was, like, just the dumbest thing. And then I just felt, like, really stupid because all the stuff that I told my kids not to do, I was doing it. I was just like, what?
You know, what's interesting about that is whenever an officer approaches a civilian, mm-hmm. there is the adrenaline starts flowing, right?
Yeah.
So maybe the civilian is not going to make the best choices at the time. You think, I'm in trouble.
Have you watched Live PD?
No, I haven't yet. I'm going to watch it now.
You need to watch Live PD.
I'm going
to
watch it
you
now.
You will see that it's an epidemic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things cops need to know is that happens, and then they need to adjust to that because they're coming into that person's space. You may say, hello, how are you? But all of a sudden, I feel like I've done something wrong.
Right.
I know I'm a Washington, D.C. special police officer. And when the police are behind me, even if they're not putting their lights on to pull me over, when a police car is behind me, my body and physiology actually changes. And I'm not afraid, but there's something visceral that occurs just when a police car is behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tracy, you're involved with the Black Lives Matter movement. And how did you get involved and why?
So initially, when I first heard of Black Lives Matter, right, I didn't realize what their impact was or what they were hopefully trying to do with this movement. But as I began to see throughout the nation, there was a lot of things that were happening that was primarily happening to Black and brown bodies. I wanted to just learn a little bit more about that and how I can get involved and always putting myself in a position that, you know, that this could happen to me, you know, whether it's my brothers or my nephews. But then I'm raising a son. And that, you know, he needs to know that his life matters while he's alive, not after he's gone. And so through a series of interactions with Hawk Newsom and seeing what the work that he was doing throughout New York City, whether it was supporting a family who had lost, you know, a family member, or just really getting out there and just talking to young people about knowing their rights and understanding their rights, but more importantly, anything about just a lot of the steps and anything just to keep them safe. Right. And I appreciated what he was doing. I saw that, you know, he and the movement was not necessarily going in to be adversarial, but they were just talking about, like, there are some things that are happening in our communities and we need to really address them, put those fires out. And so I thought, like, if I can physically, you know, be there in terms of, like, in marches or supporting the work that they were doing, whether they were going down to, you know, ask for, you know, some sort of justice or attention to situations, whether it was in Charlottesville, whether it was going down to D.C., that these are things that are really, really important. And the goal is that, you know, before all lives matter, we have to look at Black lives.
And Miguel, I have to ask you, Blue Lives Matter is a campaign that sprung up as a result of Black Lives Matter, right?
It was. I think it was a response to just a lot of the negativity that was being shifted towards the police department as a result of some of the things that happened. And sort of a response to the lack of coverage of, you know, the positive things that are done on a day-to-day basis that, that police officers do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of times things get drowned out in order to, you know, push a particular agenda. And I think that that was a result of those situations.
A lot of miscommunication.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an amazing experience. There were times when I was almost on the verge of crying when I was watching you two doing the mirror exercise. It was so beautiful and unique. It just kind of touched me emotionally. I think this is an amazing project. Terry Grease, what you've created here with this project is just something that's going to contribute to better relations with civilians and police, and hopefully it can be duplicated across the country in other thespian workshops and actually spread this knowledge and this experience across the country. Officer Miguel Van Brackel, Tracy Pinkert, Terry Grease, thank you for being on PD Stories. This has been a very special edition of this show, and I hope that everyone listening will have their lives enriched by it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.